From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made last month in a handful of southern cities, Nashville, Birmingham, Montgomery, and Selma. A group of 35 people traveled from Rochester, visiting various places in those cities, to learn about race relations, both present and historical. They spoke to the Equal Justice Initiative and the Birmingham Police Department. They studied the impact of racism in the criminal justice system, the political system, and the economic system. And they returned to Rochester with new knowledge. One of the convoy members said she learned how the hidden scars of racism impact us all. Most of the people who made the journey are part of Spiritus Christi Church here in Rochester, and with their new knowledge, they hope to work with city leaders to improve race relations in Western New York. We've asked several members of the Spiritus Christi Race Convoy to come on the program to discuss what they learned during the trip and how it can apply to their work in our city. And they're joining me in studio today. I'd like to welcome Reverend Myra Brown, Associate Pastor at Spiritus Christi Church and an anti-racism trainer. Wonderful to have you back in studio with us.
It's great to be back, Megan.
Also in studio is Lorinda Parks, a physician at Jordan Health and a member of Spiritus Christi Church. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Steve Heverin-Smith is an entrepreneur and business consultant, also a member of Spiritus Christi Church. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Melissa Parrish is a community educator, and social worker, also a member of Spiritus Christi. Welcome.
Thank you, Megan.
We have a lot to talk about this hour, but I'd like to start with you, Reverend Brown. And you're involved in a number of anti-racism initiatives, including SPARC, the Spiritus Christi Anti-Racism Coalition. But what was the impetus for organizing this particular trip?
Yeah, so I would have to really give credit to Dr. Lorinda Parks, who is a parishioner of Spiritus Christi. She actually brought the idea to me, just really deeply moved by the shootings of unarmed black men around the country and really feeling like we needed to do something to respond to that. And so we had, as you know, had a long history of doing anti-racism work. And as I heard her vision for taking people back historically to sites to really experience, to put faces to names and stories and ideologies and philosophies, it made sense. It occurred to me that that was perhaps the missing piece to our anti-racism work. And it just felt like a great fit to be able to move our work to the next level.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
This is Lorinda. I'm going to give some credit to my kids as well. So I'm a white person, and when I saw all of the sadness about Alton Sterling and, on and on, Tyree King, I was sad every time, and my kids recognized that I was sad about another African-American man getting killed by police, possibly unarmed, possibly for no reason. But they said, well, what more are we doing, Mom? You know, sometimes we'd go to a protest, but Spiritus Christi gave me the outlet to say, okay, we can do more than this. I need to demonstrate to my kids that Black lives do matter and that we're going to do more than just be sad. So my kids, my teenagers came along. There were about seven teenagers on the trip, so we recognize that youth are very integral in improving race relations as well. So those of us who are adults are here today, but we want to recognize that there were some young people as young as two and lots of teenagers that also came and taught us so much as we stood on the streets of Birmingham, saw where the children's march was and where the kids were hosed down and what that meant to both young black and white children.
So ages 2 to 70, I believe.
Yes, yes.
And it was
yes.
a very diverse group. Let's talk a little bit about the makeup of the group. So the four of you were there. Did you know each other beforehand? Were you all fairly familiar or?
So the members of the church had varying levels of interaction with each other prior. We had attended the church. I have been affiliated with Spiritus, but I'm a friend of Myra's, and I had helped her with racial justice work. So for the last 10 years, I had been around Spiritus Christi, but not necessarily attending the church on a regular basis. So over the course of the weeks leading up to the trip, we met as a group. Some of the members of the church, who all of the people who were attending from the church, met as a group. And from that moment on, we started to get to know each other and to share information. And it was the relationships were building at that point. And then we also had some community members who came on the trip as well. And Dr. Parks knew several of those members, and we got to know them over the course. So there was a mixture.
And nothing like bunking up with everybody for the week that we were together, because we basically spent a lot of time bunking up in church gymnasiums and we got together, got to really know each other.
One night, all of us were in two bedrooms, literally two bedrooms, wow. Several high
people.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we're bosom buddies now after that experience. It was definitely a rites of passage. I often joke and say we need a T-shirt, you know, that says we survived Race Convoy 2017.
The other thing unique about our trip was that we were pretty economically diverse. So there were certainly some folks that were educated, but there were some folks that really have just lived in Rochester and worked maybe at the Family Dollar throughout their life. And what did this trip mean to them to travel to the South to really see some history? So that impacted all of us.
How did you find the people who went on the trip? Was it an open call for anyone involved in the organizations, or did you ask certain people specifically?
Yeah, we put out a call. We advertised for probably, I would say, maybe a month at the church to our membership, really kind of laying out what the goal was. And so people came through that way. There were other folks who in the parish who knew people that they were connected to who thought, you know, this person might be interested as well. And so the word just kind of went out from there. And then there were, I think, particular people that were invited as well.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I was an example of a parent, and we had a couple of others, too, who had teens who expressed interest. And Spiritist made a decision that any teenager that was going on the trip, their parent had to attend. So it was interesting because normally I would be the one that's pulling my son to attend something like this. And in this case, it was him who was saying, Mom, I really want to go. And so you got to go with me.
How old
and
is
so
your
that
son?
He's 15. I have two 15 and a 17-year-old, and it was the 15-year-old that was really excited about going. Mm-hmm. So the three of us went.
And I think you all packed into two buses, and you had a U-Haul. I'm just trying to capture a picture of what this looked like as you're
three
driving.
Three
vans, okay.
12-passenger? 12-passenger vans, and then a U-Haul that carried our luggage.
Okay.
And so we were convoying down the highway.
And Steve did all the legwork on the map making.
The navigating of how we were going to take that trip. So thank you, Steve.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we had a packing team, just like when you do a high school trip. Everyone got everything loaded into the van. Usually by 7:30 in the morning, we had a big agenda ahead of us. So.
Well, we can break down each of your stops because I think there are important things to talk about in each of those cities. And I know you have priorities that you want to address. But before we get to that, I'd like to go back and talk about teenagers being interested in this trip. And you had mentioned, Lorinda, in your email prior to the show that you had listened to a song that really spoke to you. I hadn't heard that song before, but I have some of the lyrics here. But why don't you tell us about what that song is and why it impacted you?
So it's really a song that brings us back to the Nazi era where a young woman is convicted by the fact that her parents did not speak up for the Jewish folks during the Holocaust. And when she then grew up, she had to live with the fact that her family had essentially closed their eyes to this terror and horror and had not really spoken up. Now, they themselves were not being terrorized, but they could just sort of step aside and say, well, I'm not involved in that. And that I've heard that song long ago, written by Pete Seeger, but it really spoke to me about this issue of police brutality and our young African-Americans situation, because I do not think that as slaves you can get yourself out of slavery. You need to have advocates outside, and I think the same with this brutality issue now, that if we do think Black lives are important, that we all have to join together. So it was a way for me to put my feet on the ground and really show my children that this was important to our family.
And the song is called My Name is
Lisa Kelvillage.
Yes, okay. So some of the lyrics here, listeners, if you haven't heard it, they'd ask, where are my parents, my father, my mother, where they were, basically? And to this, I could answer not a thing. It goes on to say, and now I also know what it is to be charged with mass guilt. And then it says, hopefully someday my contribution to peace will help just a bit to turn the tide. And perhaps I can tell my children, 6, and later on their own children, that at least in the future, they need not be silent when they asked, where was your mother, when? Mm-hmm. And so I know that it was very important for you, Lorinda, and I'm sure all of you, because you all have children, to have your kids understand the value of being involved, not just having a sentiment or compassion, and that's important, but actually turning that into action. Yeah. Let's talk about that for a couple minutes.
Creating the world that we want to have, I mean, contrary to what most people think, you know, they lean into kind of organicism, you know, it's an evolution, it's going to happen eventually, but I think we have to be willing, intentional actors. in shaping what we want. And so when I hear that song, like that's I understand what she's plagued with. And so I certainly intend to spend the rest of my life working to end racism and creating a kind of world where my 9-year-old grandson doesn't have to live burdened with these experiences of structural and institutional racism and the violence that's connected to it. And so absolutely, I think we have to, I think we have a human responsibility to throw our hats in the ring to shape the kind of world we want.
So with that, we had to decide where were we going to go. There's endless number of places to head to learn. We decided that we were going to make stops every day. We weren't going to drive through the night. So our first stop really was in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus is a city that has a lot of police brutality. In fact, they the people that we met with there called the People's Justice Project tell us that there's 82 Black people killed by police for every million people. And that is higher than any other city in the United States. New York is 17 per million. LA is 49 per million. But Columbus is 82 per million. So they have a whole group there that's trying to do police accountability. They've had two recent deaths. A gentleman named Henry Green, who was killed by two plainclothes police officers. And then the really public killing of Tyree King, who was a 13-year-old who was shot in a park. So our first stop was to go there. We actually stood in the park where Tyree was killed. We were able to meet with a parole officer who was walking by and was able to share some of the history and the story around his killing. And then we met with the two women who are leading some advocacy for some justice for Tyree King. It was very powerful to speak with these two women. One was Black, one was white. About how they're going about and doing this work. They know a lot about the police department in Columbus. They follow carefully what practices they're doing and how what communities they're doing them in, and they're really advocating. As a white woman, the woman Molly from People's Justice Project said something so powerful to me. I know I'll never forget it. She said that when you're doing advocacy with African-American folks, as the white people, you need to stay in the room. And she really reiterated that, that sometimes we do make errors and that we don't fully understand the pain of the Black community, but that she said your face gets red sometimes as a white person and you feel so embarrassed. But regardless, stay in the room. We need to advocate together. I really appreciated that.
And what was really important about that aspect is that when partnering around these issues, there may be times when, oftentimes, when you're being asked to share power, when you're being asked to share the table, you're being asked to hear a different perspective. Or maybe you may even be challenged that a behavior or a mindset is offensive to another person. Mm-hmm. And to have the option to walk out because you're uncomfortable is a privileged position. And so for her to name that and say that and acknowledge that it's not going to always be easy in this relationship was extremely important. And also it spoke volumes for a group that was as diverse as ours was, for them to understand that there's a part of this that's also going to be, if you're going to do this work, that's going to be about looking at yourself and dealing with areas that are uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Steve, as the white man in the
room.
Yes,
the white man, yes.
what did you take away? What was the most important thing that you took away from this whole trip?
Because the trip really did impact me substantially, and my wife, who wasn't able to make it, remarks continuously how it has changed me. But as the white man and an older white man growing up in Massachusetts with very little black background, the whole idea of white privilege, there were different times within this trip, and I talked to a couple of the younger Black men there, 26-year-old and a 36-year-old, and I said, wow, I just, you know, I had to escort a woman out of the museum, and there was a ramp, and it had a closed gate in front of it, but it looked okay, so I just opened the gate up and started walking down, and they started yelling at me, and it's like, well, why wouldn't I do that? And I talked to these guys afterward, and they said, no, we wouldn't have done that, and it's just that whole the white privilege, you know. We were going into the University of Alabama, and they said, oh, you can't come in here. And there was a black man driving, and I was riding shotgun, and I just talked my way into it. And I don't think they didn't have that opportunity. So mm-hmm. white privilege to me, it's shocking to me how easy it is for me compared to somebody of color.
Well, and just that notion of, well, why not?
Right.
That others are seeing this as, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, the rule says, and, oh, that's ridiculous. Like, to have the notion to be able to question whether or not that rule is just or not is something that could be the difference between life and death mm-hmm. for a person of color.
Right. Listeners, if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call the program at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program. My email address is mmack, at WXXI.org. You can also find me on Twitter at mmackmedia. So I have a lot of questions for you about white privilege, and one of them stems from a discussion we had on the program yesterday with mayoral candidate Tony Michiquet, and he was telling the story of his youth. He was in the foster care system between 8 years old and 13 years old, and he was successfully able to find a better situation for himself, and he's since become a real estate agent and a politician. But someone called him recently and told him that he had white privilege. And he said, do you know anything about me? Do you know anything about my background? And the caller said, well, I don't know, but you're white. You have white privilege. And Tony told him his story about his struggles in the foster care system and how he worked full time when he was 14. And then the caller said, okay, well, maybe you don't have it. And Tony mentioned, maybe we shouldn't throw that term around so quickly. And that led to a discussion about white privilege and if it's a sliding scale, if it's a one-size-fits-all term. So I'd like to break that down and ask each one of you what you think. And I'll start with you, Steve, because I know that that was something that that was an interest.
And I do believe it is a, I'm not sure it's a sliding scale. It's a black and white, to me, scale. I mean, I am able to do things that a black man or Hispanic or others just isn't able to do. And I have come to understand that. I've got a biracial niece, and I've got a niece and a nephew who are adopted from India. They're very, very dark-skinned. And I worry about what they're going to have to go through, because they'll have problems that I just don't have.
This was really highlighted to us on the trip when we studied the incarceration issue. So it was clear to us that though slavery is dead from several productions like the movie 13th, that the new slavery is really incarceration. And we wanted to understand that better, and especially those of us who are white wanted to get a little bit better grip on it, as all of us did. So we went to the Equal Justice Initiative, which is based out of Montgomery, Alabama, one of the most racist places in America that still has many laws that are not equal for black folks. We were surprised by the fact that Equal Justice Initiative actually brought Anthony Ray Hinton in to speak with us. And we were all aghast, sitting in a brick-walled room with jars of soil that were taken from below the lynching sites of over 4,000 men. The weight in the room of just sitting in front of that soil was amazing. And Anthony Ray Hinton is a gentleman that was gotten out of jail in 2015 after serving 30 years on death row. He was there because he was accused of murdering someone in a county near his in Alabama, and the evidence they proved was that the bullet that killed the man came from his mother's gun. And he told us the story that as he was arrested that day, he asked the officer 50 times what the crime was, and on the 51st time, the officer said, someone was killed a county over. We know it wasn't you. I know it wasn't you. You know it wasn't you, and you're a black man, and you're going to go to jail for this. And they actually did prosecute him. After 14 years in jail, Equal Justice Initiative got a hold of him and were able to get three ballistics experts to say that the bullet was not from the gun from his mother. Now, the attorney general from the state of Alabama, who was Bill Pryor at the time, did not want to allow that evidence to be put in front of anyone. And so for another 16 years, that evidence was suppressed until it was made to the Supreme Court, where the Equal Justice Initiative lawyer, Brian Stevenson, was able to bring the same ballistics expert that had originally looked at the bullet 30 years earlier. And when he looked at the bullet this time, he said, my eyes do not see what they saw 30 years ago. You are free.
Wow.
And now, I think it's important to lift up the privileging aspects of that. Mm-hmm. We assume that as citizens of the United States, that we all have a right to do due process and justice. And as Mr. Hinton asked, well, you know, what am I being charged with? What did I do? Why have you arrested me? To have someone say, you're being arrested for murder. I don't really care whether you did it. Frankly, I don't think you did. But I'm letting you know that as a white man who's a sheriff, who has power in this town, you're going down for it. Mm-hmm. And that there's going to be nothing you can do about it and nothing anyone else can do about it. That reality, and not only did he say that, but the system supported that. He did actually end up going to jail and was incarcerated for several years. That's an example of someone's reality where they move through the world not having any control over what happens to them. And so I wanted to highlight that's a privileging aspect. The other thing I want to mention is that when someone says, a white person says, I was poor. I didn't have privilege. Privilege is broken down into categories. You can have economic, you can have some economic poverty in your experience. It doesn't prevent you from being white. It may impact you in certain ways economically. But when you walk into the room, no one knows about your economic situation yet. I mean, there are other ways that may come out. So when we talk about privilege, it's important to recognize there's dimensions to it, mm-hmm. and there's a complexity to it. And so the best thing that a person can do in understanding this concept is to learn more about the different dimensions of it. And Tim Weiss is an author who does an excellent job, a white man who is a social activist, who's been involved in doing racial justice work, who's worked alongside people of color, who's also done the work he needs to do on himself around these issues. He spent the last 30 years of his life examining these issues. I would highly recommend any white person that wants to understand privilege. He's an excellent place to start. While we were on our trip, we had a young lady, a 14-year-old teenager, white teenager, who obviously had been reading Tim and some others as well, because she did an excellent job of articulating at 14 years old how she was able to acknowledge that she moves through the world in a way that is different than her friends or her African-American boyfriend does. Mm-hmm. And she was beginning to understand that. And that's what this concept of privilege is about.
It reminds me of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I agree with Melissa. I guess when I heard you ask Steve was, is there kind of a gradient?
Right, is it, the question we asked yesterday, is there a sliding scale
sliding scale.
It more,
yeah.
For lack of a better term, black or white?
Yeah, so I would just fully step into it and say that whiteness is always a privileged position, right? Because we live in a world, a racist world that is racially constructed where whiteness is on the top, and blackness is on the bottom. Like, that is the reality. And so the assumption that, as Melissa is saying, that I was born with a little less than the average white person or whoever assumes that we start in the same place.
Right.
And the truth is that we don't. We don't start in the same place. Our skin color assures that we don't start in the same place. And so I think that would be the first reality for folks to wrestle with. I think that there are things that happen kind of invisibly for whiteness that don't necessarily happen for blackness, right, or brownness or yellow skin. I think that there are opportunities that open themselves up that closes itself to darker skin. I think that there's trust that shows up that doesn't always show up for dark skin. I think that there are investments into a person's future or life, their goals, their gifts, that will often render people of color who have those same gifts invisible, neglected, not invested in. I think there's a sense of culpability that people of color live with that white people don't necessarily, because whiteness says something else about them, whether that's real or not. So that's really what I wanted to say, that I would just ask people to fully wrestle with the context in which we live, considering our racialized history.
It reminds me of a conversation we had on the show a few months ago with Chuck Collins, who's the author of a book called Born on Third Base. And he was born into a very wealthy family. He gave up his fortune.
Listen to that. It was great.
And well, he made an analogy. He was on vacation in New England, I think, and he was riding his bike down a hill with the wind at his back, and he felt great. He thought, I'm in shape. I feel really great. This is wonderful. And then when he was finished with his ride and he was heading back to wherever he was staying, it was uphill, and he was riding into the wind. And the conversation that we had after that was about an economic privilege, but I think it relates to this conversation as well. And I think a lot of the time, and as a white person, I recognize this about myself, I don't realize how good I have it sometimes because I'm not faced with a fear of oppression. And I don't know what's inherently built into society because I've never seen otherwise. So, Reverend Brown, how would you help people that may not see this?
Yeah. I mean, one experience that we had when we were at the Tyree King site that really pricked me, that really brought it home to me, was we were talking to a parole officer, and he said he was communicating this sense that the police had about black men in Columbus. And he said, you know, I've learned, you know, to accept and with the way the police see black men, which is that to see them all equally dangerous, all equally dangerous. And I thought to myself, if that's the place that you start with every young black man you see on the street, where else do you go? Like, where else do you go, right? Like, if we said that about all young white boys, that we see them all equally dangerous, right? Or all Latina children, we see them all as equally dangerous. I mean, I think that there are these dimensions around race and the way that in which we think, and we've been shaped to think around our fears, around our judgments, our prejudices, that really, when it has teeth, is snuffing the life out of people, and particularly people of color. So for me, this is a real issue here. Because that means that there are young black men everywhere and young black children and children of color whose life is in danger because of the way somebody views them as a whole group. They have completely lost their individuality.
And we wanted to understand that in terms of the police view. So if these are your police eyes, how do you then view? So we went to sort of ground zero of bad policing, which was Birmingham, Alabama. We were able to speak with the police chief. He actually served us an amazing dinner, brought us down to the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, and sat and talked to us for 2 hours. Chief Roper started the conversation with saying, "We in the Birmingham Police Department were on the wrong side of history. We hosed down the children. We arrested them. We got the dogs out." He himself is black. And early on in the conversation, he started talking about ethics and he started talking about the racial makeup of his police department. He said, "Birmingham is a city of 72% African American folks. This police department is 72% African American." And he said that makes a difference. And we, I think, really appreciated that. Our group really saw that as true.
Absolutely.
So in the city of Rochester, we're about 42% African American. We have about 11% African American police force from the 2015 statistics that I could pull up. Does that make a difference? Well, what Myra was mentioning, that in the eyes of someone, if you look and see that every person is dangerous, if you don't know intimately other black folks, you may see that is as true. And I really think that that is an important piece that we took away from learning how the Birmingham Police Department is doing a better job. Chief Roper also teaches the ethics class to every new recruit and holds them accountable for the ethics, of which we saw the problems in Dallas in the last couple days around the death of Jordan Edwards. You know, that chief couldn't go to speak for the ethics of that officer. And as a chief, I guess you have to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that was important for me as a northerner going south was initially I had this notion of going to Alabama, going to Mississippi. Ooh, I don't want to do that. Those are places that that have so much history as it relates to being the most offensive and racist places. What I appreciated about being in those places was that that history had helped those people grow. That to have a police department that said, because of that history, never again. because of that history. They didn't apologize. They didn't run away from it. They didn't try to make it something other than it was. They didn't try to say, oh, well, you know, it wasn't so bad. Or, you know, it's those Northerners who were just trying to, you know, paint a bad picture of us. They didn't do that. And so they acknowledge, accepted that this is what was, and now we need to do better. Mm-hmm. And that was the mindset of everything that we saw. And so it definitely helped, whether we were in Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma, that history was at the cornerstone of all the work that had happened or hadn't happened.
Well, I guess one of the things that jumped out at me, and this was as we go through and we're spending day upon day upon day, you know, seeing life from the black side, from African American side, and a place we stopped at, which at the time seemed like, well, it's interesting, but it won't have as much of an impact, was a plantation. So it was a plantation from the white person's standpoint. It wasn't from the slave standpoint. And we're in there as a group, two different groups, because we're so big, and we're listening to the tour guides, and they're play acting that they're the grandchildren of the plantation founder, and they made this comment that was, well, so offensive to everybody. And they were talking about whenever a craftsman came in, they would teach a slave that craft. That was part of the deal. And the person said, so that when they were free, they would have a skill. And it's like, well, how many were free? And never got an answer. And then the thing that really broke me was the person proudly said, well, but our grandfather never bought just a single slave. He'd only buy the whole family. And that was as if it was okay. And it just struck me that they were still teaching this in the plantation. So I'm not sure how much has changed. It really shook me, and it shook all of us. We all just left.
And what was powerful for me as an African-American watching the whites in the group, from day one when we were in Columbus and some of our members were kind of taking it all in and a bit too quiet for my liking. I was like, come on, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? That was what I was thinking inside. Then towards the end of our trip, you couldn't keep them quiet. They were questioning mm-hmm. and critiquing and
everything.
who does they think they are? And what about the other story? And what about the other perspective? That was exactly what I had hoped for.
Right. Yeah.
That level of reflection and seeing a different perspective. Not just, we could have in the past walked through that tour and very politely nodded our heads and listened to what everyone mm-hmm. said, and many probably would have gone through a tour like that and done that.
Right.
Not at the end of our trip.
Well, the reflection piece of this trip is something I'd like to talk a lot about, and how you're turning all that new knowledge into action here in our city. But I'm very late for our only break of the hour, so we're going to pause for just a moment. When we come back, we'll hear more from Reverend Myra Brown, Lorinda Parks, Steve Heverin-Smith, and Melissa Parrish about the Spirit is Christi Race Convoy. And listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org, or I'm on Twitter at mmacmedia. Short break, more Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, we continue our series of conversations with candidates for Rochester City Council. Right now, there are 12 candidates vying for 5 at-large seats, and we want to give you a chance to hear from all of them and ask your questions. Candidates Dorian Hall, Dana Miller, and Loretta Scott join me in studio next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking with members of the Spiritus Christi Race Convoy. 35 members of our community took a trip down to a number of southern states and also Columbus, Ohio, to see what they could learn about the current state of race relations and connections to history. And before our break, we were talking about what the group learned in Birmingham and at a plantation. And I know, Lorinda, there's something you'd like to talk about regarding the University of Alabama. That was the next stop on the trip.
Yep. So we were able to go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which has the University of Alabama. And some professors there have been working with students through a program called SORA, junior high students who are trying to struggle with the idea of racism in their community. And it's Black and white students. And so they hosted us for an open mic spoken word extravaganza one evening when we were in Tuscaloosa. It was right on the University of Alabama campus, which holds a lot of history. So we all together did a tour. There's a woman named Authorine Lucy, who was an African-American woman who was able to attend college there, but it did not go well. There was so many protests and so much rioting that after a short period of time, she actually had to remove herself from college, but she was the first woman there, as well as lots of struggles still going on at the University of Alabama over race relations. But the students were really an inspiration to us. So there was young African-American and white students who really understood what white privilege was, what struggles they had ahead for race. And it was so encouraging to us to see that young students get it. Maybe they have a leg up on us as the older folks.
Another piece of the trip that really stood out to me was the museum you visited with the exhibit about lynching. Melissa did, Reverend Brown, Melissa, feel free to jump in. And they're so polite.
The Lynching Museum, the first thing we saw at EJI was an exhibit that had these jars of, initially we weren't certain what the substance was inside. Worst case scenario, I was thinking it was ashes. And then we later found that it was actually the dirt from sites of people who had been lynched in Alabama. Visually, emotionally, very compelling. Each jar had the name of a person, and in some cases had the word unknown if they did not know the name of the person. But it was a wall that had 100 or more jars on it, and that was just for that, for Alabama.
430.
There were 430 in total.
Wow.
And so that was extremely daunting to see that, and to know that each of those jars represented a life that had been taken violently. And so that was extremely powerful. Mm-hmm. And then we went on to see another exhibit. And one of the things that we were struck by was that this practice of being brutal and killing people was seen in the community as an opportunity for entertainment. That people would come together and pack a picnic basket and go out and sit
take home
and
souvenirs.
Watch and take home souvenirs. Yeah. And there were actually jars of, and I apologize for the graphicness of it, but body parts, fingers and limbs and feet and things that were then put in a jar and put on display in a window as a keepsake. So to see those kinds of things, it reminded us of the brutality, of the inhumanity, and also that this was a person's life that was being reduced to this level of bestiality. You know, it was just horrible.
Yeah. And so many families were complicit. They were all at the picnic.
For me, I can hardly even talk about it. I mean, it lives so deeply in me. But for me, it reminded me of the power of the distorted story. There was an image there in the Lynching Museum of all the reasons why these men were criminalized, looking at a white woman, just really trivial kinds of things, you know, thinking too much of themselves.
Talking back.
I mean, they were just outrageous kinds of things. But it was the power of the distorted story, the power of privilege, the creation of heroes and victims based on race and status and access and assumed credibility. It was just in an instant. What you look like allows you the power to decide life and death, really, for another individual. And for me, it was also about the honor of being able to honor the sacrifices of our ancestors and grieving the actions of our other ancestors who were perpetrators of such an atrocity. and just getting a sense of that collective history that we have together, which lets me know that we need collective action then to right these wrongs and make sure that we don't do that again and that we end the current experiences of racism, because the reality is that while we went south, Rochester has its own history
right.
of race. New York State has its own history of race. We have a point in history of in New York City of 1863 where we billed it as the draft war, but in fact it turned into a race war where Irish Americans were attacking African Americans, and when it was over, 11 African American men were hung in New York City. So that's the North. I mean, we went to the South, to the Lynching Museum, but we have our own lynching history here up North. And there are lots of stories. We have the sit-ins that happened in Rochester. We have the riots of 64.
Riots, yeah.
There was a whole year before that where there were racialized events in Rochester. But we are not telling those stories. We talk about the race riot as if we woke up one morning and had it. But there were a whole series of life experiences around race that we don't talk about anymore.
That's such an interesting point, because when we talk about these events, we see them as one day or one week. And you're right, we don't talk about the context. Do you think they teach that in schools?
I don't think they do. I didn't learn it in school. I mean, one of the things that I think was amazing about Montgomery was at least they had what they called the Civil Rights Park and Civil Rights Museums, places where they would retell these stories. We tend to step away from the story or distort the story or minimize the story. And I think it's really important to have the story told.
And as a person who I was first generation college, and I decided that understanding and studying African American history was an important part of my journey. And as a result, spent the last 30 years of my life working on these types of things. So I had studied them, but I had never visited these places. It was extremely important for me, for my children who have watched me do this, but are 15 and 17, and civil rights is further and further away, and the extent to which I expose them or school exposes them, it still seems as if it's something that's distant, and they're not always able to see how it connects. Well, after this trip, my 15-year-old came home now understanding why I'm so passionate about this, and understanding the shoulders of the people that we're standing on. Hopefully, if we spend more time teaching this generation of children, Black and white, what happened in the civil rights era and before, they will then not take for granted their education, take for granted their voting opportunity. They will have a sense of what sacrifice has occurred for them to be afforded the things that they have now. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the areas where, as we move on in time, we become a little bit disconnected from what used to be, and we think that it was always as it is now.
Right.
And going then, I think that the trip definitely helped my younger son experience how much he can take for granted now.
Just because we're losing the hour, I want to make sure we talk about what Reverend Brown has coming up, because I know this trip, everyone came back with new knowledge, new ideas, goals for the future. And I know that you're turning some of those into some tangible action items. So let's talk about what the future holds.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has really emboldened the work that we do around racial justice. One of the things, again, that we will be working on, putting forth a proposal that Rochester creates its own civil rights park. And there's some wonderful things that we can do with that, and really gleaning our own history as well as our state's history, so that we are reminding each other of the story and creating conversations so that we can really bring in our entire community, our entire city, to begin to do that, move the work of racial justice forward. I think the other thing is that we are planning to offer a racial justice training coming up soon. People would have to call Spiritus Christi to get those dates.
What's the number?
325-1180.
Say
325-1180 is Spiritus Christi Church. So if they gave us a call, we'd be happy to give the next dates of the anti-racism trainings that we're working towards. We're also going to be spending some time this summer thinking about taking these conversations of race into the community. They're called Corner Conversations. It's a way to engage community members around these issues and build more coalition. So that'll be happening this summer. And we're also looking at local issues of policing. We've been working with the United Church Leadership Ministries on policing issues and building those relationships, having hard conversations, and trying to move the work forward towards more justice on the way that people are experiencing public safety.
Mm-hmm. What can someone sitting at home listening do? Someone who may have the compassion, may have the sentiment, like we were talking about early in the hour. If they can't make it to a training, what's something that they can do in their everyday life to try to improve a situation?
We were really struck by the power of a conversation. So some of the members of our team would go out into the towns where we were and start race conversations just with people in the park, on the street, in the bar. And we're able to say, okay, what do you think about racism? What do you feel? And by just sharing their own experience, maybe telling a story from the race convoy, maybe sharing an example of white privilege, that really helped. It felt like we were moving things forward, because this is really about each of us understanding that we have a role in this. Following some of the police actions that are going on against African-American folks and the trials that are going on, and weighing in on whether we're really finding justice or not, is another way to keep yourself informed about these issues.
And one of the things that's really important is when you're having a conversation, to have it be two-way, to not only tell your story and your experience, but to ask a question of another person, and then to listen and to glean what it is that they're telling you is their experience and their perspective. And sometimes it may be what you're expecting, and sometimes it may not. So to truly listen and to be able to take in that person's experience, that's a huge part of the journey cross-culturally, is telling your story, but listening to another's, and then finding that how much both can evolve as a result of truly listening to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, this group,
we have an anti-racism coalition team, so people could always join us every second and fourth Monday at Spiritus Christi at 6:30. So that's a place to come and get involved. But the main thing is to pay attention. Pay attention to what's happening around you in terms of justice, and make sure the arc bends towards justice, and to get involved, to work at not dismissing other people's oppression, other people's pain, other people's experiences, and really ask the question. We had a recent issue in our community where we had one of our CVS stores that weren't stockings for African-American women. And so we didn't just say that's a terrible thing. We acted. We built some coalition. We organized around that. We made phone calls. And you know what? Within 7 to 8 days, guess what? They started ordering African-American stockings for all women other than just white women, and putting those on the shelves. So there are practical things that we can do. We have to pay attention to the injustices that are before us.
Mm-hmm. Steve, do you have any final thoughts in our last minute and a half?
I won't be the last one. But no, I think what we've all been talking about, having discussions, reading, there's so much out there. We have a whole list.
We have a packet of books that Melissa brought.
But just being able to read and understand, and I think not being afraid. I mean, it's, as a white person, just not being afraid of a black person walking down the street.
And that was powerful, because all the venues aside, we traveled with half black and half white people on a trip where we were intimately close to each other, involved all the time. And that was very powerful for myself, my children, the fact that we could enjoy these venues together and got over the little issues of what to eat, where to eat. Mm. You know, it was fabulous.
Right.
Will there be another trip? Is that in the future?
We hope to make this an annual event. I think that it is really important to have this be a piece of it, to have the work of racism not just be an intellectual exercise. I think there's a certain amount of talking that we can do, and then there's a lot of action that needs to happen. And I think it's important to be in spaces where you can feel it and touch it and sense it. And so, yeah, they will definitely.
Absolutely.
And a big thank you to those who dedicated 6 days, you know, giving up 6 days of vacation or time or your children's time, to all 35 of those people. I am truly honored that they made it a spectacular experience.
So for more information, Myra, if you can repeat where people can learn more.
They can call Spiritus Christi Church, 325-1180, 325-1180 at Spiritus Christi Church.
And I know the anti-racism group is on Facebook, correct?
We do. We have a Facebook page, Spiritus Christi Anti-Racism Coalition, SPARC.
SPARC. S-P-A-R-C.
S-P-A-R-C.
Yes. Very good. I'd like to thank all my guests for coming in today.
Thank
what
you.
A valuable conversation. Thank you. And I know we'll continue these conversations in the future, so I'd welcome you all to come back.
Thank
Melissa
you.
Parrish, Steve Heverin-Smith, Lorinda Parks, and Reverend Myra Brown, all from Spiritus Christi Church. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having
thank
us.
You
thank you for having
us.
Absolutely. Up next on Connections, we're talking to three candidates for Rochester City Council. Stay with us.